Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
You may be the first president in history to go down because you can't stop inappropriately talking about an investigation.
I can definitively say the president's not a liar, and I think it's frankly insulting that that question would be asked.
Up to now, we have no profiles in courage among the Republicans. Somebody really speaking out saying Trump is bad for the country.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who's gone from swamp to sewer, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Have you been watching what's been going on in Poland? The populist Law and Justice Party swept into power in 2015, and the leader, Jarosław Kaczynski, started pushing illiberal reforms. And the most troubling act is his judicial reform bill, which was intended to bring the Polish Supreme Court under political control. Nobody had much confidence in the president, Andrzej Duda, who's a member of that same populist party. He's a hack politician and has gone along with everything else. But Duda surprised everybody this week by vetoing the bills that implemented those changes. Duda hasn't joined the opposition, but he stood up for the independence of the judiciary against a politician who was trying to run roughshod over the separation of powers and the rule of law. Well, we're on the verge of the same situation here. And based on their past record, nobody has much confidence in Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan to stand up to Donald Trump when he threatens political prosecution as a political tool or bullies judges. These guys have been his patsies since he locked up the nomination last spring. But if Trump goes beyond tweeting and takes a genuinely outrageous step like firing Robert Mueller, some sense of public conscience or constitutional responsibility may strike these guys yet. We obviously can't count on Ryan or McConnell. Every indication is they put party loyalty first. But as Trump's challenges to the constitutional order become more and more brazen, don't be surprised if one of our own leading hacks finally has enough and pulls a Duda. Coming up on the show, Trump's chief ideologist, Steve Bannon. I'll speak to Joshua Green of Bloomberg Business Week and the author of the new book, Devil's Bargain, right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Joining me in the studio is Joshua Green. He's the author of the new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Josh, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you were on the show once before when you were covering the Trump campaign for Bloomberg Business Week, but your interest in Bannon started, I mean, you were the person who I think kind of put him on the map when you did that cover story in Bloomberg Business Week couple of years ago, 2015, that was sort of the first attention he got around Breitbart and the alt-right and his role in the Trump campaign. And
well, it wasn't his role in the Trump campaign right. at the time. It was his role plotting the Clinton Cash book that was meant to kind of tear down Clinton, who became Trump's eventual opponent. But he wasn't really Trump wasn't really on the radar in any serious way back then because he was still, you know, a political punchline and was not yet President of the United States.
And their hooking up made sense because Bannon was looking for a political vehicle, someone to push these far-right ideas, these alt-right ideas into the mainstream. And Trump was, of course, looking for someone to help him get elected.
Yeah, and Trump was like his fourth choice because I met Bannon in 2011. I was working at the Atlantic at the time, and I had just come back from Alaska doing a big piece on Sarah Palin's governorship because a lot of us thought that Palin was going to run for president in 2012. She was certainly hinting that she was going to. And I wrote a big kind of slaty contrarian piece that said, you know, if you look at her record, she actually did some good things as governor. She fixed the state's budget and she raised taxes on oil companies. And I just got a call from a film publicist who said, hey, I represent this filmmaker. He read your article. He loved it. He's doing a film on Palin. Will you come to the sound studio in Arlington, Virginia and meet him and watch his movie? I said, sure. And the next day I went and it was Steve Bannon. And so at the time, he had the exact same politics that he does now, same affect, same look, you know, the military field jacket, disheveled wild man thing.
Worn with cargo shorts and flip-flops.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, looks like a bloated alcoholic. And so a couple weeks after that, he and I and Andrew Breitbart and like the entire National Press Corps traveled out to Pella, Iowa to debut this movie in what everyone thought was a wink-wink announcement that Palin was going to run for president because it was in Iowa.
Yeah.
So Palin didn't end up running. So Bannon next moved on to Michelle Bachmann and weirdly, even to Jeff Sessions, which is something that Emily Bazelon has written about, as potential presidential vehicles. None of it really worked out. And then lo and behold, you know, Trump decides to run and Bannon had actually been in his orbit for quite a while. And Trump becomes the vessel for his what he calls populist nationalism.
So he and Bannon is, for better or for worse, well, for worse, the intellectual core of the Trump presidency. I mean, he is the ideologist. He's the one who is steeped in certain bigger ideas outside of immediate politics and is trying to implement those ideas through politics. So, you know, what I want to ask you about is what those ideas are. People talk about them being connected with fascism, with white supremacy, with anti-Semitism, with, you know, there's a whole history to that. Where do Bannon's ideas come from? What are his ideas? It's a big question.
So, during the campaign, I think it was BuzzFeed found video in a transcript of a conference that Bannon had participated in at the Vatican, but it was held by this far-right Catholic outfit. And in his video, Bannon goes on this wild rant about how we're entering a dark age where millions of people are going to be slaughtered. And he name-checked a guy named Julius Evola, who was an Italian intellectual in the interwar period who became Mussolini's
He was Mussolini's Steve Bannon.
He was Mussolini's Steve Bannon, exactly. And then they had a falling out and he moved on to Nazi Germany. So part of the reporting for the book was I went to Bannon and I said, look, you know, you claim not to be an anti-Semite and a white nationalist, and yet here you are name-checking Evola. If you're not all those things, why is it that you seem so intensely interested in these philosophers from the 30s and 40s who built a lot of the intellectual framework for Mussolini and Hitler and outfits like that? And he said, kind of matter-of-factly, well, you know, I'm a nationalist and I believe this stuff. And I went looking for an intellectual underpinning for my beliefs. And if you want to find nationalist philosophers, that's when they were the most prominent. That's when they were the most active. And so, yes, that's why I read Evola. You know, he wrote a famous book called Revolt Against the Modern World, Evola did, that, you know, painted the picture of this world in decline as it moved away from God toward apocalypse. And that jibes very much with Bannon's own grandiose understanding of history and his role in it. But what he told me was, you know, Evola is not really the guy. He said, you know, he had a godfather, this massive intellectual, this is Bannon's term, massive intellectual named René Gagnon, who I went and read Gagnon. He was born in the late 19th century in France, raised as a Roman Catholic, practiced occultism and Freemasonry, and eventually converted to Sufi Islam. And Gagnon is the founder of a religious philosophy called traditionalism with a capital T, sometimes known as primordial traditionalism. And this is going to sound like something out of a Dan Brown novel, but the idea at the heart of primordial traditionalism is that there is that in the earliest ages of mankind, God revealed certain esoteric truths that lie at the heart of all the ancient religions, the Hindu Vedanta, Sufism, paganism, and that this knowledge was lost to the Western world, beginning with the Enlightenment. So this is essentially an anti-modernist philosophy. Evola, unlike Guignon, believed that finding transcendence was not about spiritual transformation, that it was about societal transformation. And so Evola made common cause with Mussolini, with Hitler, and tried to enact his ideas that way. He mostly failed and wound up as an avatar of right-wing Italian terrorists in the 60s and 70s, and now is very popular with Richard Spencer and white supremacists. But Bannon claimed, no, that was not the part that interested him. It was this idea.
It was the first chapter.
Right? It was the first idea of the client. And Guignon's famous book is called Crisis of the Modern World.
Yeah.
So you can see the through line in this idea of crisis. But what's so batty about all this, not to cast aspersions on anyone's religious beliefs, is that Bannon and Guignon and Evola are all believers in the Hindu concept of cyclical time. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. The idea that the world passes through certain stages. So, Guignon and Evola believe that we are right now in the midst of what Hindus call the Kali Yuga, a 6,000-year-long dark age when man's connection to God, to tradition, is wholly lost. And so Bannon's way of fighting against that, as Evola's was in a different context, is to try and set right-wing nationalism against that and sort of destroy these globalist governmental groups like the EU, these secular bureaucrats who are taking us off in this ungodly direction and return backwards to an almost medieval time.
So Josh, my hat is off to you for really reading this stuff and getting into it and trying to figure out what Bannon actually thinks and what his intellectual sources are. But isn't the bottom line that he believes in a lot of intellectual BS? I mean, this combination of, this guy's, philosophy is Sufi Islam and Vedanta and Freemasonry. I mean, this is intellectual charlatanism. And
I don't think it's charlatanism. I think it's intellectual masturbation might be a better word. I think that Bannon really does believe a lot of this stuff. You know, one of the things I tried to do was, having spent a lot of time with the guy, was just understand, what is firing your pistons here? Like, what is motivating all this? Like, what is your major gripe or complaint? And what makes you so, virulently anti-Islam, anti-immigrant? And his explanation is that basically, he thinks that we're headed toward this apocalypse and that, he needs to reassert American identity and cultural norms and this and that. Maybe that's just a glossed up version of kind of ordinary run of the mill, bigotry, racism, what have you.
How does he square the sort of Catholic traditionalism, like everything went wrong when we stopped saying the Mass in Catholic, with American nationalism, which is very much populist and Protestant, and not about a group of high priests being the only ones to keep with the key to knowledge?
So he's a Tridentine Catholic. Yeah. He says Latin Mass, the whole thing. His parents are, they converted to get more traditional while the church was modernizing after the Vatican II reform. I think the answer to that would be that he would say that Catholicism is our tie back to the tradition, back to tradition, that we are moving away from that as people move away from the church, as countries, again, Bannon's language, erase their national borders and hand over their sovereignty to the likes of Angela Merkel and the European Union. His one novel he likes to cite is the Camp of the Saints,
this kind crazy of
dystopian,
French novel,
French novel from the 1970s, in which these marauding Muslims kind of invade and take over Europe and the Catholic Church. And in the novel, there's this kind of liberal, pro-immigration, globalist pope. I think Bannon just gets whipped up on this idea that this is happening, that this is real, and he fits himself for a very big position and kind of fighting on behalf of civilization. I mean,
But what I don't get, and I guess it's a small point, but it's sort of how that squares with supporting this exclusivist, esoteric brand of Catholicism. I mean, Vatican II happened in part because they wanted to bring people into the church, right? And it's like if you're pushing everybody out of the church by making it so difficult to be a Catholic, you're in a poorer position to compete with Islam.
That's not the way he's looking at things at all. He thinks that the church has been taken over by what he calls a liberal Jesuit globalist. Bannon is very much aligned with the traditional Catholic factions in the Vatican. He actually started up Breitbart Rome and hired this kind of like dissident fallen ex-priest to run it and has met with Cardinal Burke and a lot of these Catholic traditionalists. That's why he was doing this Vatican conference where he mentioned Evola, to try and prop up that part of the church. I mean, I think he believes the church has been taken over by forces of globalism, yada, yada, yada. But part of his, you know, battle is to try and win back the Catholic Church. I mean, this is all I realize how ridiculous this sounds, but this is what he talks about. This is who he reads. This is what he says he's doing.
And let me ask you a series of blunt questions about him. I mean, do you think Bannon is a kind of fascist?
I think he is fascist curious. I think he gets.
Oh, well, that's a relief then.
No. But a big. He gets excited. I mean, he's a propagandist, and he's obsessed with propaganda films. And he thinks, as I think Trump thinks, that those fascists had real power, and that maybe there's a way to kind of draw from some of what they did and bring it into our own politics. Would Bannon go all the way to fascism? Maybe. Would Trump? Probably. But I really don't know. You know, it's kind of one of those unanswerable questions, or at least I don't think I could get a satisfying answer out of him.
Is Bannon a racist?
I don't think he is a racist in the sense that he would put on a Klan hood and go around marching. And it's a tough question to answer because, you know, I heard him at various points, and I quote him in the book, saying things, you know, that were anti-Muslim, that were anti-immigrant, that were sexist. I never heard him say anything that was racist or anti-Semitic. You know, there are black employees who work for Breitbart. And yet, if you look at the kind of headlines they run, you know, black on black crime, marauding Black Panthers, so on and so forth, they certainly.
And this French novel he's talking about is a racist book.
Yeah.
So if your favorite novel is a racist book, you know, it's not case closed, but it's certainly case open.
Yeah. And I asked him about this. And in fact, somebody at the Vatican conference asked him about this too. It's on the videotape. He said, well, how come that, you know, the hard right is so infected with anti-Semites and white supremacists and racists? I asked Bannon the same thing and got the same kind of answer. He kind of shrugs and waves it off and says, well, you know, we're all outsiders. You can't really pick and choose who your allies are. You know, we're going to kind of take over and then all that stuff will just wash out. So he is, at the very least, not bothered by any of this. I think you could go further and say that he's abetted this stuff, not only in the kind of articles that Breitbart ran and the headlines that were given, in the explicit emphasis on race and on black people and immigrants as these kind of menacing figures, but also in how he gave rise to the likes of Milo Yiannopoulos and helped channel in a lot of this ugly alt-right sentiment in political actors from kind of the gamer underworld into Breitbart and Trump and our modern political process.
Vladimir Putin has a sort of Steve Bannon who's called Alexander Dugin.
Yes.
What's the connection there, and do they play the same role for their respective authoritarian inclined leaders?
They do. And what's so bizarre and interesting about that is Dugin is also a capital T traditionalist. Like Bannon, before Bannon came along, Dugin was sort of the most prominent traditionalist. He translated the works of Julius Evola into Russian in the early 1980s, and he helped give Putin a kind of Russia-first nationalism that is based on the tenets of traditionalism. Dugin gave it a Russia-centric spin. He calls it Eurasianism, and it's the idea that there are these traditional Russian values and that the rise of secular modernity and the acceptance of homosexuality and all the stuff that Putin rails against is kind of part of the same thing that Bannon is objecting to in a U.S. political context.
So, Josh, you explained in the book how Bannon made a lot of money himself, but he has very important financial patrons. The Mercers.
Yes.
Can you talk about them and what they, how they see Bannon and what they want out of this?
So the Mercers are Robert Mercer, who is the co-CEO of Renaissance Technologies, a very secretive hedge fund out on Long Island that I believe Bloomberg, my employer, said is like the most profitable hedge fund of all time. And his daughter, Rebecca Mercer, who is very politically active in Republican circles, but especially in kind of hard right fringy stuff. And they met, I think, in 2010, 2011. It was while Andrew Breitbart was still alive. But the Mercers got interested in Republican political giving in much the same way that other rich, politically motivated conservatives do. I think they gave to Karl Rove Network. They gave to the Koch Brothers Network. And then after all of that flopped in 2012, the Mercers became angry and they broke off. So I describe them as the alt Kochs in the book.
Yeah.
Instead of funding traditional outlets, they backed Bannon and a number of ventures. Breitbart News, I think they put in $10 million and helped him to expand. Cambridge Analytica, they bought a piece of the data science firm, the U.S. Outlet. But the one that interested me, and this was the basis of the 2015 Business Week profile, which is the first time I really wrote about Bannon, was they funded a nonprofit research institute called the Government Accountability Institute, which was devoted to researching cronyism in politics. And the president of GAI, a guy named Peter Schweitzer, had done a lot of investigative work on Congress, on Republicans and Democrats, teamed up with major mainstream media outlets. Bannon and Mercer, I think, encouraged him to really focus on Hillary and Bill Clinton and their financial ties through the Clinton Foundation to shady foreign characters. And they spent millions of dollars in a couple of years and had teams of lawyers and forensic accountants and kind of deep web specialists gathering all this information, putting it into a book. And Bannon's idea was, if we can just get facts on Clinton and hand it to the mainstream media, then we can seed the mainstream media with our anti-Clinton narrative in a way that conservatives were not able to do in the 1990s when they just had all these batty theories and rumors that had to be cycled through British tabloids and Drudge Report. And sure enough, it basically worked. The book came out on the eve of Clinton's announcement, but the reporting from it first appeared on the front page of the New York Times, where there was a big above-the-fold article by Joe Becker and some other people about the money Clinton had taken from, I'm going to mess this up, it was a uranium magnate who I think was doing deals in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Frank Giustro, but it gave millions and millions, like $30 million or something to the Clinton Foundation. And, you know, it caused an uproar, and it also led to a Margaret Sullivan column. She was the ombudsman at the time, because a lot of people complained and said, wait a minute, where you're bringing this from this book, Clinton cash by these partisans. Why is this in the New York Times?
But what do you think the Mercers want? I mean, you've explained really well what Bannon wants. He wants to reverse 6,000 years of cultural decline. Yeah. What are the Mercers? Is this about the self-interest, their self-interest in the taxation of hedge fund gains, or is this about ideology in some deeper way?
You know, I've never interviewed Bob Mercer. He doesn't talk, neither does Rebecca Mercer. I have a hard time believing it's only about the facts that the hedge funds are taxed too much. I mean, they've got $1 billion. I'm sure that's one component of it, but they just seem to want to kind of blow up the system, and they're particularly infatuated with some very strange ideas. My colleague at Business Week, Zachary Mider, wrote kind of the original profile of Bob Mercer. And Zach went out to Oregon and found the first candidate that Mercer ever backed, who is this weird research chemist who lived alone in the woods and collected thousands and thousands of samples of human urine because he thought it was the key to extending life. And he was running in a congressional campaign against the incumbent Democrat, just to give you a flavor of what it is.
It's the flavor of urine and a lot of urine.
Oh, God. Thanks for that thought. But so it's hard to know exactly, like, what does someone like that really want out of the political process? I honestly don't have any idea.
You actually can't make any sense out of it.
How could you make sense out of that?
Yeah.
You know? And I just got to get this in because we're talking about urine. And Rebecca Mercer, apparently during the Trump transition, tried to get this guy, Urine Man, appointed to the National Science Council. So...
hasn't happened yet.
You ask what she wants out of politics? There you go.
Yes, exactly. Well, he will be ambassador in charge of yellow snow to Northern Territories. Last thing I want to ask you about, Jeff Sessions. So if you said, how is Steve Bannon going to start to get the policies that he wants inside the Trump administration? You'd say, well, he got this guy, Jeff Sessions, appointed to Attorney General. It's his ally, and he's implementing all this stuff. Trump doesn't seem to want to fire Sessions, at least so far, but he's trying to get him to quit. He's trying to push him out.
Is he?
Certainly seems like it. But give me your take on it. And where is Bannon in all this? I mean, is Bannon just kind of cringing on the sidelines, glad that it's not Bannon? Or is Bannon just unable to influence Trump in any way? What's going on with the three of them?
I think it's a lot. I mean, Bannon has worked so hard to kind of crawl his way back from nearly getting pushed out of the White House after his Time magazine Great Manipulator cover kind of enraged Trump, and Kushner was trying to stab him in the back and get him out of there. And Bannon hung on, and he kind of crawled his way back to a position of influence.
Just to be clear, he just got in trouble because he got attention, and Trump's like, all attention belongs to me.
As a White House advisor put it for you, Trump doesn't want any co-stars, and I think that's exactly right. So, you know, Bannon had just gotten back, and all this stuff happens with Trump. I'm sure that Bannon is anguished because Bannon thought that getting Sessions installed as AG was the whole key to imposing his idea of nationalism, A, because Sessions believes in it, which Trump obviously does not, but Sessions and Bannon both do, and B, because he's the highest law enforcement official in the land and has broad purview over immigration laws, criminal justice reform, and kind of push back against everything that Obama has done. And we've seen that. Arrests are up. Sessions has sent administrative judges down to the border, extra ones to help process these deportations. Just yesterday, I didn't get attention for obvious reasons, but Sessions put out a statement kind of threatening sanctuary cities to have their federal funds withdrawn if they didn't start turning these people over to the cops. So Sessions is like the only guy in the Trump administration who's actually carrying out the things Trump ran on. And here he is just getting creamed by his own president, publicly humiliated. I mean,
because of the case in which he tried to follow the law, right? He followed the guidelines on recusal.
But it wasn't even that honorable, right? I mean, Sessions originally didn't recuse himself. And it was only after he'd been caught essentially perjuring himself, hadn't revealed these meetings with Russia, that he was all but forced to recuse himself. So this wasn't an issue of like, you know, Southern honor and doing the right thing. He didn't have any choice. The fascinating dynamic to me is that anyone with an iota of honor and integrity would resign the first time a president publicly humiliated them like that. And yet Sessions really believes this stuff. He cares about it more than Trump does. And he realizes this is the only position of influence he'll ever be in his life. He's a gadfly senator before this. He gave up his job.
Yeah.
But even if he were to go back to his job, he wouldn't have any real influence. I mean, he's in a position now where he does, and he can't bear to give it up. So as is true with so many people in Trump's orbit, he is willing to suffer seemingly any humiliation and indignity and just see his reputation ruined and destroyed by virtue of his association with Donald Trump.
There was a report, I think, yesterday that Steve Bannon brought Ann Coulter into the White House. That she reamed Trump out about immigration or not being tough enough on all the things the Breitbartians care about. What's going on there? Is Steve Bannon trying to use a proxy to get through to his president?
Yeah, and it's not just Steve Bannon. I mean, a lot of people in the White House that are very – and outside the White House and Republican Party, they're very upset by what Trump is doing to Sessions because they understand that Sessions is a true believer and is carrying out the policies they support. But Coulter, who is, you know, virulently pro-Trump, anti-immigration, legal and illegal like Bannon, and actually ghostwrote parts of Trump's immigration policy white paper, a story I tell in the book, during the campaign when there was no policy infrastructure, went in and I think read Trump the Riot Act and said, you know, you promised to do all these things, your base believed it, And now you're turning around and assassinating the one guy we want in there who's really carrying it out. Stop it. And you heard the same thing from Breitbart News yesterday and Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Charles Krauthammer and Tucker Carlson. I mean, this is the first time that I have seen where Republicans have been willing to criticize Trump in anything more than the most kind of timid and frightened way. There really have been some people who've kind of come out and said, Trump is wrong to do this and stop it. Of course, Trump isn't listening.
You think the dam's finally breaking with the Republicans?
No.
So just a few outliers are being a little braver. But
this is the classic, kind of performative nonsense that you get from a lot of people. They come out and say, you know, I'm very disappointed in the president. I wish he'd stop tweeting. And then they don't do anything to back up that quote unquote disappointment. Look at Paul Ryan. I mean, we've been through the cycle 100 times with Ryan. Until somebody is willing to say, I'm not voting for any of your bills or to confirm any of your judges, you know, because I'm angry about this. Until there's something to back up the supposed disappointment, I don't think it's making any difference at all.
I've been speaking to Joshua Green of Bloomberg Businessweek. His new book is Devil's Bargain. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Hey, are you following us on Twitter? We're at Real Trumpcast. You can find the whole gang there, including Jason DeLeon, who produced today's show. Thank you, Jason. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.